All right, today we return our attention to the book of James, chapter 4. There was some discussion among the pastoral staff regarding how many verses we should attempt in a single message as we get into chapter 4. And we've decided to take it in smaller chunks. Now, you would think that means that you get out earlier today, but oh, don't get too excited just yet. You know, let's wait and see how this goes. And so we're only going to be looking at verses 11 and 12, but I want to remind us all of verse 10 in chapter 4 that we ended with last week. James says, "Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you." Humility was the theme. It was the focal point. It was the whole concentration of those previous verses and the problems that flow out of pride. Pride continues to be the theme. This is an extension of what began with James calling us in chapter 3 to have godly speech, to be careful of the tongue, to be watchful of our words. This is simply continuing that application of surrender that is necessary in order for God to be able to work through us. Now again, we're talking to the church. He's not talking to the general population. He is specifically focused on people who proclaim to be believers in Christ and followers of Him, and yet have gone astray, or are at least in that moment potentially so. And so he writes this letter to the churches to be shared among them as a means of discipleship, knowing that in some cases it'll be corrective and in others it'll be instructive. You decide where it belongs in your life. What I've found along the way so far in the book James is that it's both for me. There's one moment where I feel instructed by God. There is another where I feel corrected, and sometimes both at the same time. So if all you're getting is instruction and not any correction, you may not be doing it right. So be careful of that. This is intended to do both. The outcome should be that we become closer in our connection to Christ, more godly in our behavior and in the manner in which we live. Now, though, as he calls us to humility, as he requires of the believer humility before God and trust by faith in him that when the day of exaltation comes that he will be the one that lifts us up, he then immediately turns and condemns self-righteousness. So this week and next, we're going to look at two expressions of sinful pride. The first is the sin of self-righteousness. In James 4, 11 and 12, we see this laid out for us with very specific clarity. James is teaching practical lessons of genuine faith that works in the way we live every day by emphasizing to us the application of faith as it applies toward others. So here's a really good litmus test of genuine faith. Does it positively impact my relationships with other people? Start with those that are closest to you, family relationships, then extend it out to friendships, co-workers, fellow students, and just keep going out until you get to person X. Person X is that individual that you meet along the journey of life that you see once and probably will never see again. How does it influence all of those things? The influence that we have in the lives of others matters. There's purpose in it. You may not see it at the time. It may not be something that you'll see in your lifetime. But that doesn't mean that it isn't still applicable. And so people and our relationships with each other and how we conduct them and the manner in which we manage them over the course of life, involving both love and grace, forgiveness and acceptance, challenges and strength, grief and loss, all of the various emotional ups and downs that come out of that, faith is always going to be best expressed in the context of our relationships with each other. I will also add to that that faith that does not get expressed in the context of our relationships is false faith. Jesus said, love God, love your neighbors yourself. He didn't say do one and you get half credit. You got to do both. And it has to be in that order. Love God, love others. And so James is helping us to understand that royal law. He's helping us to understand that instruction that Jesus has given, and he's doing it in the most intimate context that is possible on this earth. Nowhere is daily living more on display than in our relationships with others. This is why speech is so important. This is why the moral condition of the heart has such a profound influence on our behavior. To further this principle, James now addresses the relationships within the body of believers. He is protecting the unity and the integrity of the church by warning of the destructive influence that seeps in when we fail to love others as we claim to love God. John has something to say about this as well in 1 John 4 in verse 20. He says, if anyone says, I love God, but hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother. The sin of self-righteousness is in direct opposition to the command of Christ to love God and love others likewise. So, verse 11, chapter 4, James, he says this, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Immediately, he comes right out of the gate with an injunction, a command, an imperative statement. And he says, absolutely, do not speak evil against one another. Now, what I found interesting is that commentators will spend a great deal of time explaining to us what the phrase speak evil actually means. In many translations, it is the word slander. And you'll see it translated as such. That is equally accurate. But in the English Standard Version that I'm preaching from, using the word speaking evil is more descriptive. And so rather than just giving you a word and letting you kind of make up your own mind about it, the ESV goes a step beyond and translates it into an understandable phrase. Speaking evil is, in fact, slander, or the definition of slander. And so we're dealing with synonyms said different ways so that we have a better understanding. He says, do not do this. Now, can that be gossip? Sure it can. Can it be deliberate false witness against another? Sure it can. Can it be neglect and indifference toward another? Absolutely. Can it be a harsh tone? Yes. So it's not just what we say, but it's also how we say it, and it's the manner in which we distribute whatever it is we are saying. He says, absolutely, draw the line, do not speak evil against one another. Again, he puts it in the context of the church. He calls them brothers. Remember that previously he's called them something else. But now he again affirms the brotherhood, the sisterhood, the family relationship that exists within the body of Christ, and he is speaking directly to the body of Christ. And he says this is a command, absolutely imperative. Now, does it follow along with what he said about godly speech? It certainly does. But here it is the kind of speech that we have with regard to another when that person isn't present. And he says, this is something that the body cannot do and survive. It tears apart relationships. It ultimately breeds discontent and conflict. And it will eventually lead to division within the church and separation from others. And thus, it will cause all of the commandment to love God and love others to completely implode and collapse in on itself. We are commanded against slander and evil speech toward others. This goes right along with what Paul teaches when he says, let no unwholesome speech come out of your mouths, but only what is suitable for building others up. This is a difficult thing, yet it is also a necessary thing. Notice what he says with regard to this. When he says, do not speak evil against one another, it automatically should make us think the reasons of why we would even consider doing such a thing. Speaking evil against others flows from pride in oneself. It is because we have decided that someone else is less valuable or is in some way less appropriate than we are. It's almost a kind of a sideways manner in which we are attempting to bring someone else down while deflecting from ourselves any attention that would come against us. Tearing down others is a twisted way of building up self. Again, in direct contradiction to the command to humble yourself before God so that He can exalt us, that is stated for us in the previous verse, in verse 10. Tearing down others in order to build up ourselves, deflecting attention away from our own shortcomings to those of others, all of this is nothing more than a veiled and vain effort to cause us to feel better about something that we should feel bad about. How do you feel about feeling bad? Well, I don't like it. Well, I don't guess anybody does, but isn't it a reality? Wouldn't you think that it says more about our faith when our actions are observed while we feel bad than it does about our faith as we are observed when we feel good? How do you act when you feel bad? Well, I'm a bear. I was reading an article from the conservation that there are 800 bears in Missouri. I think there's a whole lot more. And I'm one of them. When I feel bad, what is it that we want to do? We want everybody to share the joy, right? Everybody else feel bad. Misery loves company. I think that what James is trying to help us to understand is that human relationships are kind of tricky, and they're also very fragile. And the best way to guard and protect those relationships is with the focused attention of faith on who Christ is and who He is making us to be. And in order to enhance that, we cannot get caught up in the negative speech against one another that directs the attention away from our own issues or that somehow causes us to feel superior when we really should feel convicted. And this deflection of our own problems and sin doesn't make them go away. It simply delays the reality of the weight that will come to bear eventually. Tearing down others is not the answer. He says that when we slander each other, when we speak evil against each other, we've passed judgment on others and determined that they are guilty, yet somehow that we are not. Yet because of our own inherent sins, it is impossible for us to judge another person in regard to this life or in regard to their eternal condition. And that's exactly what James is addressing. He is saying that when we speak evil against others, the one who speaks evil against his brother or judges his brother is speaking evil against the law and judging the law. He is saying that we are in a better position to bring judgment or pass judgment on someone else than the Word of God is. Judgment of others simply isn't something that you and I are equipped for. Now, I realize that this is a big deal. You know, I've told you that surveys have indicated to us that the most popular Bible verse in America is no longer John 3:16. The most popular Bible verse comes from Matthew 7. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Now, that verse has been, and whether or not it is the most popular, I don't know. It's not my most popular one, but the surveyors didn't call me, so I didn't talk to anybody from Gallup about that. If you did, by the way, I'd love to hear about it. So be sure you look me up and let me know about your poll experience, because that would be interesting to me. I believe that it's probably nothing more than further efforts on the part of those who influence media and such to try and create an environment within our society and culture in which everything is okay and nothing is ever wrong and nobody should ever feel bad. And I'm just telling you, there's nothing wrong with feeling bad, especially when you've been bad. The more you grow comfortable with a world that is destined for destruction and is actively pursuing its own demise, the more you become comfortable with being separated from God rather than joined to God. That's dangerous. It isn't just compromise. It is a conversion of a much darker type. Judgment of others simply cannot coexist with love for others. You can't love someone as Christ has loved you and at the same time pass judgment on them. Speaking evil against others is judging them not only in regard to their condition in this life, but also in regard to their eternal state, something we simply are unable to do. Underlying the bad behavior is a flawed understanding of the law to love God and love others. To disregard the law, he says, is to judge the words of Jesus as inadequate or as no longer relevant to you. So when you pass judgment on someone else and speak evil against them, you judge the law. Now, is he talking about the Mosaic law? Well, probably so. But if you read in Leviticus 16, you'll find that the Mosaic law specifically says, love your neighbor as yourself. When Jesus was asked, how do we understand the most important of all that God has given us in his law? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Then he said, on these to hang all of the law and prophets. So I'm not shortening it. I'm just making it very specific in the way in which Jesus did. So when he says that we are judging the law, what we're saying is that the law to love God and love others is insufficient to change the human heart. And what we really need is we need an iron fist wielded by a human being. And he says no. That is not the case. If the royal law, think about this and stay with me, if the royal law to love God and love others is insufficient for those around you, then what law of grace is sufficient to save you? If it isn't good enough for everybody else, probably not good enough for you either. When we judge the royal law as insufficient, we obviously, he says, are not being obedient to the law. So if we become judges of the law, we are no longer doers of the law, but a judge. We're no longer practicing that which we proclaim. We're no longer actively engaged in that which has so transformed and changed us. James makes it very clear that we are to be doers of the word, not hearers only. Likewise, we are to be doers of all that Jesus has called us to. What would change in your life if you were to take this injunction to not speak evil against another person? How would that change your social media? If you were to make the decision that you weren't going to read the evil speaking that others are doing in social media, what would be left on your Facebook feed? We have created a culture in which we have removed the inhibitions that come from face-to-face confrontation. And we have elevated the very worst and even celebrated the very worst in what we say about each other. You say, yeah, but that's the world. No, it's not. Do you know the delicate balance that goes on within a church family and a church body over the course of a given week, in which there are efforts that are being launched all the time in order to manage the disparities and the differences and the conflicts and the issues that arise just within the church family? It happens all the time. Sometimes it's unseen. Sometimes nobody knows about it. Maybe it takes place between one or two people at a time, and then maybe it's resolved and it doesn't ever rise to an elevation level where it is a full-blown conflict within the church. But there are many times where that is not the case. And there are many other times where the conflict may not be leaking out in this way, but it is always kind of just simmering below the surface. I thank God that we have such peace as we do in our church family, and I'm grateful for the unity that we enjoy, but I also know that even in that environment, it is something that remains a point of vigilance for all of us if it is to continue. And not vigilance just to make everybody happy, vigilance to love God and to love each other in the same way. It's grace. Grace changes how we feel about each other. So we must refuse to speak evil. Secondly, we need to renew our devotion to God. By the way, the first point has twice as much in it on my notes as the next two. So if you're feeling nervous, you probably have good cause. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he says in verse 12. He is able to save and to destroy. Notice James brings the attention right back to God. Renew your devotion to God. I'm giving it a positive spin because that's ultimately what's going to happen if we do what he says. He reminds us of this almost as a warning, but then he also does it as a calling. There is only one lawgiver and one judge, and he has abilities far beyond our own. God alone is the lawgiver and the only judge of the heart. Only God can give inerrant truth that will sustain and bring life, and only God can determine whether or not you have received that truth. God alone is the lawgiver, but he's also the one who judges the heart. And that means he doesn't need my help. He doesn't need my influence. God has called us to love him, but also to love others. That's hard to do sometimes. Isn't it? It's hard to let that slide. When you see injustice or when you see brokenness, I'm not saying that we don't encourage one another, that we don't reach out to the lost, that we don't reach out to those who have gone astray. I'm not saying any of that. I'm not saying that discipline isn't something that the church is called upon to practice personally and corporately. I'm not suggesting any of those things would be removed. That would just lead to chaos. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about evil speech. Not constructive help. We're talking about evil speaking of another that passes judgment with disregard for whether or not that person can be redeemed. There's a story that I was told early on in my ministry education. I've mentioned to you on numerous occasions over the years the influence that a professor in college had over me. His name was Bill Skazik. I think of Bill every once in a while, especially if I'm over north of Washington. Bill loved blood sausage. Nasty stuff. But there was a little deli over in Dutso or somewhere just outside of Dutso that made it and sold it. And there were three of us in his Greek class. We'd been in his Greek class. We'd been in his Christian ministries class. He did a Christian ministries tour of the state Baptist institutions, which back then included the hospital, Baptist Hospital in Kansas City, the Children's Home, Baptist Home for the Aged. It was a two-day trip in a bus that he drove, and we'd be going down Interstate 70 or 44, and he'd come to a screeching halt and swerve off onto the shoulder of the road and jump out. He was only about 5'4" and almost that wide, and he'd go walking, waddling, rolling, whatever it was he did, out into the middle of the highway. And the first time he did it, we had no idea what he was doing. He was picking up bungee straps that had come off of the 18-wheelers. He must have had a pickup truck bed full of them. Said he used them for everything. Quirky little guy. We got in the car one day, and as we were getting ready to graduate, just before one of our last classes, and we drove over to Dutzell, we bought him a big bag of blood sausage. It was just, couldn't even hardly look at it. And I'm not particularly squeamish. In fact, I'll eat anything once. But I think of Bill all the time. He told a story early on. He said, boys, he said, you've been called to ministry. You're learning the language of the Bible. You're trying to understand how to put together sermons and Bible studies to help disciple believers. And he said, you've been called to reach out to the lost in this world with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he said, I'll never forget one of the early experiences I had of witnessing to someone. And he said, the person was a pretty bad dude. But he said, I was just determined to share the gospel with him. And he said, I shared the gospel with him, and then I kind of waited for the blowback to come. And he said, there wasn't any. And I said to him, so what do you think about what I've shared? He said, well, I think I'd like to talk about it some more. Bill said, I was so surprised, and I told him that I'd heard that others had tried to reach out to him and things like that. And he said, I didn't know what to tell you when I got to the part where I explained that when we reject Jesus, that our sin puts us in a position of opposition to him, that eventually we end up going to hell. And Bill, you're not the first person that told me I was going to go to hell. He said, you're just the first person that didn't seem happy about it. This is what he's talking about. James isn't telling us that we don't declare the unvarnished truth of the gospel. James is telling us that our devotion to God should translate into a heart for others. God alone is the lawgiver and the judge of the heart. You and I have been called to share that grace. God is able to save by his grace. It says that he alone has the ability to save and to destroy. He saves us by his grace. When we judge or speak against others, we are disregarding the grace of God that has not only saved us, but also the same grace that could save them. And when we ignore God as the ultimate judge, we assume a position of righteousness that is inappropriate. We forget that he alone is fit to judge sin and evil and to bring it to its ultimate eternal conclusion. So he says then, thirdly, not only renew your devotion to God as you reflect on his character and nature, but he says, also remember your need for grace. In light of all that he has said, this last sentence, who are you to judge your neighbor? If we were to put this into modern language, James would have said, what are you thinking about? What is wrong with you? Who are you to judge your neighbor? I think about things like that a lot. I ask myself, who am I to proclaim this word to you? Who am I to represent Jesus in this world? I'm not perfect. I struggle. I'm broken. I have scars, some of which self-inflicted, others not. I'm like everybody else. I carry around with me the weight of my emotions just as you do. And sometimes they influence me in the way I think or the things I do or say in a manner that they shouldn't. Every day is a new day with new opportunities, but also new challenges, and we all get through it the same, not with just grit and determination, but with grace and with love. James isn't trying to condemn us for speaking evil against each other. He is trying to help us love God. The more we love God, the more that the gospel and the spirit within demands that we love each other. All James is doing is saying that to try it otherwise is wrong. It won't work. Do it this way. Who are we to judge others? We're not equipped for that. But we are equipped to love each other. He didn't give us what we would need in order to pass judgment on those around us. He gave us more than what we would need to provide grace to those around us. So as we see the sin of self-righteousness, we see how it devolves into a legalistic mindset in which we become haughty and holier than thou to the degree that we not only separate ourselves from each other, but we separate ourselves more importantly from God. A proper understanding of God will always yield the right perspective of who we are. Seeing ourselves in light of the grace of God enables us not only to a greater experience of that grace ourselves, but also to a greater experience of that grace toward others in the body and those who are lost. Remember that verse that I mentioned is so popular these days? Listen to it in Matthew 7. Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Isn't it interesting how this all began? With James being concerned that believers were focused on other people instead of themselves. And it ends not with a greater awareness of the brokenness and sin of others, but now with a humble experience of the log protruding from our own eye, our own sin. I think that the greatest thing you can take away from this sermon is not a decision to never speak evil against others, although that'd be great. I think the greatest thing that you can take away from this is a greater awareness that God alone is judge, and that the only thing that you are absolutely beyond any question responsible for before Him is to love Him first and to love each other always. Sin of self-righteousness will make you do the opposite. Grace is the only thing that makes this great.